I've been reading Job lately. And I guess, unfortunately, it's the first time I've really read it while paying attention. I've read it before, but I actually paid attention this time. And I feel like there's some misconceptions about the book of Job. You know, all I ever really heard was he's this righteous guy who was really rich too, but he had everything taken away from him for no apparent reason. But he responded well, and he got everything given back to him, and even more. And he had these three really good friends that helped him through his rough time. And, you know, that's about all I ever really heard about him. But as I read and paid attention, I found some different things. So today we're going to walk through the book, kind of get an overview of what exactly it's all about, and pick up some lessons along the way that we can apply to ourselves. Good place to start, the very first verse. Job chapter 1, verse 1 says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil." Verse 6, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, 'From where do you come?' So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking back and forth on it.' Then the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?' So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face.' The Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person.' So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord." And we know what happens after that. Everything Job has, he has tons of camels, donkeys, sheep. They're taken away from him all at once. His servants killed. His sons killed. Here's his response. Verses 20 through 22. "Then Job arose, tore his robe, and shaved his head, and fell to the ground and worshipped. He said, 'Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.' In all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong." Wow, I'm impressed. But it doesn't stop there. Chapter 2, verses 3 through 6. "The Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, and blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? And still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause.' Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Skin for skin, yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now, and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face.' The Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life.'" The end of verse 10. Well, we know, you know, Satan curses Job with this horrible, painful boils, scraping himself with a potsherd. And the end of verse 10 says, "Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? And all this Job did not sin with his lips." You know, our attitude tends to be conditional. We are more than willing to accept good from God. It's at those times that it's easy to bless the name of the Lord, as Job did, to worship him, as Job did. But when things go awry, we fuss. We complain. We act as though the good is due us and the bad is just rude. Shall we not accept good from God and adversity? As I read this, I thought to myself, who do we think we are? That we can take the good just fine, but then something inconvenient happens and we're offended. It's kind of funny. But Job has a different attitude at this point anyway. He does not sin with his lips. Doesn't charge God with wrong. He worships, he blesses the name of the Lord, and he's willing to accept the adversity with the good. Who is he to complain? It's at this point that Job's three friends come into the picture. Verse 11. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. For they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. Verse 13. So they sat down with him on the ground. They got down to his level. 7 days and seven nights. And no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. His friends also at this point, I think, are responding well. I'm sure that all of us at some point or another, perhaps multiple times, have lost something on this earth that was important to us. Maybe a person we loved. Maybe health. Maybe a job. Maybe a home. Name it. We've all at some time or another lost something that was important to us. And when that happens, we don't want patted on the back and told everything's going to be okay. The good old phrase, I know how you feel. Nobody wants to hear that. We want to grieve. That's part of the healing process. Process by which we can move on, keep going. It's what needs to happen. They saw that his grief was great. So what did they do? They sat there on the ground. And they didn't say anything. There's just kind of a small lesson there for us, I think. Maybe a side note, you could even say. What a good way to help, to comfort. And so it begins. Chapter 3 and verse 1. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And thus begins like 35 chapters of dialogue. And this entire chapter, chapter 3, is him, in a very elaborate way, wishing he'd never been born, or at least died at birth. But listen to verses 23 through 26. Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, and whom God has hedged in? For my sighing comes before I eat, and my groanings pour out like water. For the thing I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, for trouble comes. Wait a minute, so he's been afraid of this. I get the impression that all along Job has been here enjoying his riches, and yet in the back of his mind, oh man, what if it gets taken from me? What if I lose it? Oh, I sure hope that doesn't happen. What deserves to be greatly feared? Or more accurately, who deserves to be greatly feared? Easy, God, right? Can you think of anything in this book that deserves to be greatly feared other than God? Is anything mentioned? I don't think so. Well, if you're terrified at the prospect of losing something on this earth, honestly, it's kind of a warning to me that perhaps priorities are not in the correct place, right? Did Job's possessions deserve to be greatly feared, or the prospect of him losing them? I don't think so. What about verse 26, where he says, I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, for trouble comes. Trouble takes away your rest? Let's turn to the book of Psalms, chapter 16. Verses 7 through 9. This is written by David. And he was chased for the better part of his life by the most powerful king of the time. Do you think he knows what trouble is? Has trouble come to him? Yeah. Verses 7 through 9. I will bless the Lord who has given me counsel. My heart also instructs me in the night seasons. I have set the Lord always before me because he is at my right hand. I shall not be moved. Therefore my heart is glad, and my glory rejoices. My flesh also will rest in hope. Where's his rest? In hope. The source of hope, God. How about chapter 37, verses 7 through 8? Rest in the Lord. Wait patiently for him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who brings wicked schemes to pass. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. It only causes harm. Where is the source of our rest? In God and in the hope that is in him. Throughout the book, I've found that the main mistake Job makes is him trusting in himself and finding his comfort in the world. As we go along, that'll just be reiterated time and time again. His trust in himself and his comfort in the world. He's not locating them in the correct place. The trouble took away his rest. Trouble can't take away God. Eliphaz responds in chapter 4, basically saying here that man is imperfect, but God is perfect. Chapter 4, verses 6 and 7, is not your reverence your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? Why is your hope in the integrity of your ways, or your reverence your confidence? Those both belong to God, right? Remember now that whoever perished being innocent? Or where were the upright ever cut off? Chapter 5, verse 6. For affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble spring from the ground. In other words, this stuff doesn't come from nowhere. It is probably a purpose. Verses 8 through 13. As for me, I would seek God, and to God I would commit my cause, who does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number. He gives rain on the earth and sends water on the fields. He sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He frustrates the devices of the crafty so that their hands cannot carry out their plans. He catches the wise in their own craftiness, and the counsel of the cunning ones comes quickly upon them. Psalm 33, verses 10 through 12. The Lord brings counsel, or the counsel of the nations, to nothing. He makes the plans of the peoples of no effect. The counsel of the Lord stands forever, the plans of his heart to all generations. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people he has chosen as his own inheritance. And then back to Job chapter 5, and let's read verses 17 through 18. Behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Therefore, do not despise the chastening of the Almighty, for he bruises, but he binds up. He wounds, but his hands make whole. I think one of the main points that Eliphaz is making here is sometimes we think we've got it figured out or something. We're doing all right on our own. Job's got all this stuff. It's going well. Going well. But he's got his plans, his craftiness, his cunning, his counsel. And sometimes God's got to frustrate it. You got to turn it around and make you remember who exactly is in charge here, where your success is coming from. But at the same time, I kind of wonder if Eliphaz is being a little bit hasty here. You know, talking about how affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble spring from the ground. How, well, obviously, you know, if all this bad stuff is happening to you, you must have done something wrong. You're being punished. And we see this a lot from all three of his friends, basically accusing him of wickedness as a source of his trouble. I wonder if that's a little bit harsh, especially for the circumstances. At the end of the book, this is kind of a sneak peek, I guess, God is angry with his three friends, so obviously there was something that they didn't do quite right, so I guess I'm suspecting here, or speculating on what these things must have been. But is Eliphaz a little too sure of himself? Could he have said something maybe a little different, something to the effect of, there's always something going on behind the scenes. God isn't random. He doesn't just randomly throw these troubles at you. We don't know what's going on, but God does. And perhaps you do. And at the same time, we are very subtle, even to ourselves, right? sometimes God shows us things about ourselves through trials that we didn't know of before. Sometimes these trials are there, well, like all the time, these trials are there for a growing process. Remember in John 15 talking about abiding in Jesus and being the vine. And we are the branches, and the ones that produce fruit he prunes so that they can do more. You suppose pruning is a pleasant process? No. Is it better? Yes. Perhaps that could be what this is for you, Job. Maybe that's something Eliphaz could have said. And so he gives advice to Job on how to react to his situation. Verse 17, "Behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Do not despise the chastening of the Almighty." Don't be hasty in the way you view your circumstances. Don't despise it. Perhaps there's something good going to come of it. In response, Job wallows in self-pity. That's the only way I can think to put it. Chapter 6, and we'll just look at verses 2 and 3. "Oh, that my grief were fully weighed, and my calamity laid with it on the scales, for then it would be heavier than the sand of the sea." Wow, okay. We just see so much self-focus in this part of Job's dialogue. Verse 11, "What strength do I have that I should hope? And what is my end that I should prolong my life?" Well, I would be depressed too. And I would be in despair if I was focusing on my strength or my hope. There again, trusting himself, finding comfort in the world, is where Job went awry. Chapter 7, verse 13, a continuation of his dialogue, I guess. "When I say, my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint." Whoa, what's comforting you? Your bed? Your couch? Really? That's the source of your comfort. No wonder, bud. What else do we have? Verses 19 through 21. "How long will you not look away from me and let me alone till I swallow my saliva? Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target so that I am a burden to myself? Why then do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I will lie down in the dust and you will seek me diligently, but I will no longer be." That seems awfully harsh to be speaking to the Almighty, don't you think? I'd be a little wary to address God in that way. Who exactly does he think he is here? Is that how a lowly man should address God? I think not. Then Bildad speaks up. And he talks a lot about cause and effect. It kind of, you know, a lot like Eliphaz was saying, here's all these bad things happening. What do you suppose is the cause? These trials and troubles are the effect. And we see through history that that comes from wickedness. Kind of accusing Job again of what's going on. Verses 3 and 4. "Does God subvert judgment, or does the Almighty pervert justice? If your sons have sinned against him, he has cast them away for their transgression." Verse 6. "If you were pure and upright, surely now he would awake it for you and prosper your rightful dwelling place." And then verse 20. "Behold, God will not cast away the blameless, nor will he uphold the evildoers." And Job responds. Chapter 9. We'll read verses 2 through 4. "Truly I know it is so, but how can a man be righteous before God? If one wished to contend with him, he could not answer him one time out of 1,000. God is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and prospered?" This is kind of a head-scratcher here, because what did Job just get done doing? Speaking harshly and in a superior manner to God. And then he talks about God being wise in heart and mighty in strength, and how it's impossible to harden yourself against him and prosper. It's like he doesn't even realize what he's saying. Which in and of itself is a lesson for us. You know, sometimes we'll preach little sermons like this and not really realize that we ourselves are kind of the subject of it. So keep that in mind, I suppose. Verses 20 through 24 of chapter 9. Though I were righteous in my own mouth would condemn me. Though I were blameless, it would prove me perverse. I am blameless, yet I do not know myself. I despise my life. It is all one thing. Therefore I say he destroys the blameless and the wicked. If the scourge slays suddenly, he laughs at the plight of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, who else could it be? Well, I got a pretty good answer of that. What did we read in chapter 1, verses 11 through 12? That Satan was the one doing this. Who else could it be? Well, Satan, bud. Don't blame God for this. I just found that kind of ironic. And then we have verses 32 through 35, which I almost hate to read aloud. For he is not a man as I am, that I may answer him, and that we should go to court together. Nor is there any mediator between us, who may lay his hand on us both. Let him take his rod away from me, and do not let dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak and not fear him, but it is not so with me. Ugh. I can't imagine God being very pleased at being talked to like that. He continues on, verses 1 through 3 of chapter 10. My soul loathes my life. I will give free course to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. No way to admit it. And I will say to God, do not condemn me. Show me why you contend with me. Does it seem good to you that you should oppress? Accusing God of oppression? That you should despise the work of your hands and smile on the counsel of the wicked? I have a feeling the only person smiling there was Satan. Got him. Good. He's blaming God for all this. Accusing him of oppression, of smiling on the plans of the wicked. Careful, Job. Be very careful. Zophar now takes his turn. Chapter 11. And some of this is really kind of neat to listen to. Verses 7 through 11. Can you search out the deep things of God? Can you find out the limits of the Almighty? They are higher than heaven. What can you do? Deeper than Sheol, what can you know? Their measure is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. If he passes by, imprisons, and gathers to judgment, then who can hinder him? For he knows deceitful men. He sees wickedness also. Will he not then consider it? Verses 13 through 19. If you would prepare your heart and stretch out your hands toward him, if iniquity were in your hand and you put it far away, and would not let wickedness dwell in your tents, then surely you could lift up your face without spot. Yes, you could be steadfast and not fear, because you would forget your misery and remember it as waters that have passed away. And your life would be brighter than noonday. Though you were dark, you would be like the morning. And you would be secure because there is hope. Yes, you would dig around and take your rest in safety. You would also lie down, and no one would make you afraid. Yes, many would court your favor. Job responds by essentially blaming God of being random and whimsical, just doing this and that for no apparent reason. Verses 23 and 24 of chapter 12. He makes the nations great and destroys them. He enlarges the nations and guides them. He takes away the understanding of the chiefs of the people of the earth and makes them wander in a pathless wilderness. Just kind of a sample of that. And I think it's kind of ironic what he says in chapter 13, verse 8 through 12. Will you contend for God? Will it be well when he searches you out? Or can you mock him as one mocks a man? He will surely rebuke you. And if you secretly show partiality, will not his excellence make you afraid, and the dread of him fall upon you? Your platitudes are proverbs of ashes. Your defenses are defenses of clay. Who does that sound like? It sounds like Job, and yet he's saying this himself. So we'll see how that goes for you, Job. Your own prediction comes true on yourself. I'm just amazed at the pride that he displays here as well. Look at verses 2 through 4. You're talking to his friends. What you know, I also know. I am not inferior to you, but I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to reason with God. But you forgers of lies, you are all worthless physicians. Man, okay. And listen to his prayer in verses 22 through 23. Then call and I will answer, or let me speak, then you respond to me. How many are my iniquities and sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. Careful what you wish for, Job. It's kind of ironic. He's going to get exactly that. It happens later. We'll come to it. And I just happen to notice here that he's been living on false hope this whole time. 14, verse 19. As water wears away stones, and as torrents wash away the soil of the earth, so you destroy the hope of man. If your hope erodes, it can be taken away little by little. What kind of hope is that? And does that sound like it's anchored in a steadfast God? Or perhaps lashed to the fallible things of this earth? Certainly don't blame it on God. That's your bad, Job. Eliphaz speaks up. Chapter 15, verse 6, he says, "Your own mouth condemns you, and not I. Yes, your own lips testify against you." Well, that's true enough. Verses 12 and 13, "Why does your heart carry you away, and what do your eyes wink at, that you turn your spirit against God and let such words go out of your mouth?" And then verse 31, "Let him not trust in futile things, deceiving himself, for futility will be his reward." Just kind of the overview of what he says there. And then Job continues with his same old, same old. Chapter 16, verses 2 through 5. "I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are you all. Shall words of wind have an end, or what provokes you that you answer? I also could speak as you do. If your soul were in my soul's place, I could heap up words against you and shake my head at you. But I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the comfort of my lips would relieve your grief." Well, sure, easy for you to say right now. Bildad, chapter 18, verses 2 through 4. "How long till you put an end to words? Gain understanding, and afterward we will speak. Why are we counted as beasts and regarded as stupid in your sight? You who tear yourself in anger, shall the earth be forsaken for you, or shall the rocks be removed from its place?" And then throughout the rest of his dialogue, he basically accuses him of being wicked, talks about the further destruction that it is to come on the wicked people. And this is another speculation I've gathered, is notice how personal everyone's taking it throughout all this. These four people just insulting each other, and that's not even the point, you know. The point is Job's going through a rough time and he's not really sure what's going on, and yet they're all just taking it so personally and insulting one another. Perhaps that's one of the reasons God is unhappy with them. In response to Bildad, Job kind of continues to blame God for his problems. Chapter 19, verses 7 through 11. "If I cry out concerning wrong, I am not heard. If I cry aloud, there is no justice. He has fenced up my way so that I cannot pass, and he has set darkness in my paths. He has stripped me of my glory and taken the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side, and I am gone. My hope he has uprooted like a tree. He has also kindled his wrath against me, and he counts me as one of his enemies." Well, actually, it kind of sounds accurate that he has uprooted his hope like a tree. Maybe that's exactly what Job needs. If his hope is in the wrong space or wrong place, uproot it. Show him where it really belongs. Give him true hope. Zophar then takes the liberty to preach the result of the wicked. And chapter 20 is literally just talking about the destruction that is due wicked people. We'll look at verses 4 through 7. "Do you not know this of old, since man was placed on earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the hypocrite is but for a moment? Though his haughtiness mounts up to the heavens, and his head reaches to the clouds, yet he will perish forever like his own refuse." Is he implying that Job is like this? That he's just this wicked person who deserves to be destroyed? Kind of seems like it. And then Job literally contradicts him. And chapter 21, look at verses 7 through 9. "Why do the wicked live and become old, yes, become mighty in power? Their descendants are established with them in their sight, their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, neither is the rod of God upon them." Completely contradicting him. Kind of makes you wonder what the point of all their all their windy words are. Then Eliphaz reminds us all, and especially Job, of who God is. Chapter 22, verses 2 through 3. Can a man be profitable to God, though he who is wise may be profitable to himself? Is it any pleasure to the Almighty that you are righteous? Or is it gain to him that you make your ways blameless? I suppose that's kind of a good point, is it? Sometimes, perhaps we can get full of ourselves and think that our service to God is a big deal. That he just really appreciates all the good that we do for him. Well, not really. We're his creation. It's just a speck compared to him. So, thanks, Eliphaz. That's a good reminder. What exactly does our good do for God? You know, just like Paul on Mars Hill talking about, he doesn't need the work of our hands and our temples and our sacrifice. He's the one who gives us life and breath and everything else. Verses 21 through 27. Now acquaint yourself with him and be at peace. Thereby good will come to you. Receive, please, instruction from his mouth and lay up his words in your heart. If you return to the Almighty, you will be built up. You will remove iniquity far from your tents. Then you will lay your gold in the dust and the gold of Ophir among the stones of the brooks. Yes, the Almighty will be your gold and your precious silver. Ah, that's a good point. For then you will have your delight in the Almighty. Lift up your face to God and you will make your prayer to him. Job responds again with the same old, same old. 23 verses 2 through 4. Even today my complaint is bitter. My hand is listless because of my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. Arguing with God. I don't know what I think of that. He feels separated from God. Verses 16 through 17. For God made my heart weak, and the Almighty terrifies me, because I was not cut off from the presence of darkness, and he did not hide deep darkness from my face. This made me think, if your faith is only good for the light, what kind of faith is that? If your faith only really works when things are going well, what good is it? Psalm 23:4. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me, your rod and your staff comfort me. By the way, that's where your comfort should be, Job, is in the rod and staff that you are bitter and complaining about feeling right now. Not to mention that the valley of the shadow of death didn't even scare David. Didn't even make him blink because God's with him. His rod and staff comfort him. That's what our faith is good for. The valley of the shadow of death. Not just the high hills and the nice little prairies. And Bildad has a nice short little dialogue, how refreshing compared to everything else that we had to endure. Dominion and fear belong to him. He makes peace in his high places. Is there any number to his armies? Upon whom does his light not rise? How then can man be righteous before God? How can he be pure who is born of a woman? If even the moon does not shine and the stars are not pure in his sight, how much less man, who is a maggot, and a son of man, who is a worm? Reminding us of our place as humans. And then listen to Job's pride. Chapter 27, look at verses 2 through 6. As God lives, who has taken away my justice, and the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me, and the breath of God in my nostrils, my lips will not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. Far be it from me that I should say you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. May my enemy be like the wicked, and he who rises up against me like the unrighteous. My. Listen to him take what belongs to God and give it to himself. His integrity, his righteousness. He's so degrading. Look at verses 11 and 12. I will teach you about the hand of God. What is with the Almighty I will not conceal. Surely all of you have seen it. Why then do you behave with complete nonsense? And then he talks about wisdom. This whole section just kind of made me scratch my head, because where is he coming from? He is all over the place here. One minute so prideful, and the next talking about wisdom. 28 verses 20 through 28. From where then does wisdom come, and where is the place of understanding? It is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. Destruction and death say, we have heard a report about it with our ears. God understands its way. He knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and sees under the whole heavens to establish a weight for the wind and apportion the water by measure. When he made a law for the rain and a path for the thunderbolt, then he saw wisdom and declared it. He prepared it. Indeed, he searched it out. And to man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to depart from evil is understanding. He continues on in chapter 29. It's like he saw himself, his old self, before the destruction came upon him. He saw himself as God. Listen to the way he talks about himself. Chapter 29, verses 21 through 25. Men listened to me and waited and kept silence for my counsel. After my words they did not speak again, and my speech settled on them as dew. They waited for me as for the rain, and they opened their mouth wide as for the spring rain. If I mocked at them, they did not believe it, and the light of my countenance they did not cast down. I chose the way for them, and sat as chief. So I dwelt as a king in the army, as one who comforts mourners. That all sounds like it belongs to God, not you, Job. Look at chapter 30, verses 20 through 23. Talking to God, I cry out to you, but you do not answer me. I stand up, and you regard me, but you have become cruel to me. With the strength of your hand you oppose me. You lift me up to the wind and cause me to ride on it. You spoil my success, for I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living. And then yet another chapter of Job ranting and how he's righteous in his own eyes. 31 verses 4 through 8. Does he not see my ways and count all my steps? If I have walked with falsehood or if my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed on honest scales that God may know my integrity. If my step has turned from the way or my heart walked after my eyes or if any spot adheres to my hands, then let me sow and another eat. Yes, let my harvest be rooted out. He goes on like this. And then we have chapter 32, verse 1. So these three men ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. They gave up. They were like, that's it. We tried, man. But we've got nothing else to say. And then this guy named Elihu comes into the picture. And the wrath of Elihu, the son of Bearer Rachel the Buzite, of the family of Ram, was aroused against Job. His wrath was aroused because he justified himself rather than God. Also against his three friends, his wrath was aroused because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job. Elihu says in verse 10 through 11, therefore I say, listen to me. I also will declare my opinion. Indeed, I waited for your words. I listened to your reasonings while you searched out what to say. Here, I think, is an important part. You know, God doesn't say anything about Elihu later on. So it seems like Elihu did something that was right. He listened. He listened to it all. He waited to see what was going to become of this before saying anything. I think that's a valuable thing for us. If there's anything, what's the word I'm looking for? With conflict, there's a conflict. Wait it out, you know. Wait until you hear the whole picture before making your statement. I think that's a lesson we can learn from Elihu. He starts out by giving credit to God. Chapter 33, verses 4 through 7. The Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty gives me life. If you can answer me, set your words in order before me. Take your stand. Truly I am as your spokesman before God. I also have been formed out of clay. One more verse. Surely no fear of me will terrify you, nor will my hand be heavy on you. He tells us how exactly Job was wrong. Verses 8 through 13. Surely you have spoken in my hearing, and I have heard the sound of your words, saying, I am pure, without transgression. I am innocent, and there is no iniquity in me. Yet he finds occasion against me. He counts me as his enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks. He watches all my paths. Look, in this you are not righteous. I will answer you. For God is greater than man. Why do you contend with him? And then chapter 34, verse 37. He says he adds rebellion to his sin, telling Job what he has done wrong here. That he's justifying himself rather than God. He's taking God's place. He's adding rebellion to his sin. He then reminds us of man's place in general. Chapter 34, verses 4 through 15. Let us choose justice for ourselves. Let us know among ourselves what is good. For Job has said, I am righteous. Have I already read this? Hold on a second. Yeah, I did already read this. Maybe I'm at 45. Through 15. Yep, chapter 35. Sorry, typed it wrong. 35, 4 through 15. I will answer you and your companions with you. Look to the heavens and see, and behold the clouds. They are higher than you. If you sin, what do you accomplish against him? Or if your transgressions are multiplied, what do you do to him? If you are righteous, what do you give him? Or what does he receive from your hand? Your wickedness affects a man such as you, and your righteousness the son of man. Because of the multitude of oppressions, they cry out. They cry out for help because of the arm of the Almighty. But no one says, where is God my Maker, who gives songs in the night? Who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth and makes us wiser than the birds of heaven. There they cry out, but he does not answer because of the pride of evil men. Surely God will not listen to empty talk, nor will the Almighty regard it. Although you say you do not see him, yet justice is before him, and you must wait for him. And now because he is not punished in his anger, nor taken much notice of folly, therefore Job opens his mouth in vain. He multiplies words without knowledge. Essentially saying, don't flatter yourself. Who exactly do you think you are? What if you do something wrong, do you think that really hurts God? Or if you do something good, do you think it really benefits him? He contrasts Job's attitude with God's attitude. Chapter 36. Behold, God is exalted by his power. Who teaches like him? Who has assigned him his way? Who has said you have done wrong? Tells him to stand still. Pay attention to what's going on. Verses 14 through 24. Listen to this, O Job. This is chapter 37, by the way. Stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. Do you know when God dispatches them and causes the light of his cloud to shine? Do you know how the clouds are balanced? Those wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge? Why are your garments hot when he quiets the earth by the south wind? With him have you spread the skies, strong as a cast metal mirror? Teach us what we should say to him, for we can prepare nothing because of the darkness. Should he be told that I wish to speak? If a man were to speak, surely he would be swallowed up. Even now men cannot look at the light when it is bright in the skies, when the wind has passed and cleared them. He comes from the north as golden splendor, with God as awesome majesty. As for the Almighty, we cannot find him. He is excellent in power, in judgments, in abundant justice. He does not oppress. Therefore men fear him. He shows no partiality to any who are wise of heart. And after this, God speaks up. It's about time. Chapter 38, verses 1 through 3. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man, and I will question you, and you shall answer me. Well, that would get my attention. Not only is there a whirlwind, but God's voice speaking to me and accusing me of these things that I know in my heart are true. And I think it's kind of ironic what he says in verse 3, prepare yourself like a man. This word man essentially means warrior. In other words, if you think you're all this, you know, this manly guy, this stud, you think you're all that, right? Well, prepare yourself like one. And now let me ask you some questions. He asked Job a whole bunch of questions. I'll just take a sample of it, verse 19 through 21. Where is the way to the dwelling of light and darkness? Where is its place, that you may take it to its territory, that you may know the paths to its home? Do you know it because you were born then, or because the number of your days is great? You know, there's some things that we don't even think twice about because they're so normal to us, like light and dark, or time, or gravity. We don't even think about it. But God invented it all. He invented light. He invented dark. And I just get a kick out of what he says in verse 21, because the number of your days is great, from God, who's timeless, and Job is old and thinks he's all wise because he's old. So God says, yeah, because you're old, sure, you know all this stuff, don't you? Putting Job right in his place. And then take a look at chapter 39, verses 10 through 12. Can you bind the wild ox in the furrow with ropes? Or will he plow the valleys behind you? Will you trust him because his strength is great? Or will you leave your labor to him? Will you trust him to bring home your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? Wait a minute. That's kind of funny. Trusting your life to an ox, right? Will you trust him to bring your grain, or trust him because his strength is great? It's just an ox. But at the same time, do we kind of do that? Was Job kind of doing that? Putting his trust in his sheep and donkeys and camels that all got taken away from him? Do we do it today? Put our trust in the things that serve us? Isn't that kind of backwards? God finishes up chapter 40, verses 1 through 5. Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. Then Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further. Wait a minute. He promised about how he wants to bring his case before God, take God to court, argue with him. He's got bitterness in his soul. We read all of that. And now here's his chance. And he says, I lay my hand over my mouth. I ain't got nothing to say. Where is that case you wanted to present, Job? Maybe you should have thought about that. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Would you indeed annul my judgment? Would you condemn me that you may be justified? Have you an arm like God, or can you thunder with a voice like his? Then adorn yourself with majesty and splendor, and array yourself with glory and beauty. Disperse the rage of your wrath. Look on everyone who is proud and humble him. Look on everyone who is proud and bring him low. Tread down the wicked in their place. Hide them in the dust together. Bind their faces in hidden darkness. Then I will also confess to you that your own right hand can save you. Can your right hand save you? Can you clothe yourself with majesty and splendor and array yourself with glory and beauty and do all these things that God talks about? Job complaining so much about the injustice of his situation, and now God asks him, is he the master of justice? Is he the one that brings the proud low and gives the wicked what they deserve? And then he continues on talking about, you know, the behemoth and the leviathan and all these things that we don't really know what they are, but they must be something big. And essentially what he's saying here is, if you can't even tame these dumb beasts, what makes you think you can backtalk me? There's just something so incredible about a direct quote from God, you know, and a big one like this. It really ought to be taken to heart. Closing up the whole story, chapter 42, verses 1 through 7. Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you. Therefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. And so it was, after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, My wrath is aroused against you and your two friends, for you have not spoken to me what is right, as my servant Job has. Tells them to offer sacrifices and ask Job to pray over them. Verse 9, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite went and did as the Lord commanded them, for the Lord had accepted Job. That's definitely a happy ending. And the Lord restored Job's losses when he prayed for his friends. Indeed, the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Verse 16, after this, Job lived 140 years and saw his children and grandchildren for four generations. The result was repentance. You know, God never changes. What he always says always stands. And what he said that is true for Job is true for us too. There's some lessons that we can learn from Job. One of them being that it's folly to trust in ourselves and find our comfort in this world. And it's always good to be reminded of that. We know it's true. I think every single human is hardwired to know that that's true, to know that there's more to this life than meets the eye, and that there is something going on behind the scenes. It's important for us to be reminded of that because sometimes we get full of ourselves, just like Job did. But again, the end result was repentance from Job. He repented of his folly. And God accepted him, as I said. And that is the beauty of this story, is that God restores. Restored Job's losses, restored Job himself and his three friends. So we offer the invitation, if you have not been restored, and we invite you to, as we stand and sing.